My name's Chris Kirk, and this is TW Talks, the interviews podcast from Free Weeks Edinburgh. I am at the Edinburgh Festival 2025. I'm sitting in the club bar at Assembly George Square, right at the heart of the fringe, and I'm going to be talking to performers who are appearing at this year's festival, talking past, present, and future, their journey in comedy to date, this year's show, and what is happening next. Today, Bert Williamson, whose show 104 Kilograms of Pure Banter is appearing as part of the PBH Free Fringe of this festival. Let's get TW talking with Bert. So we are here in the club bar at Assembly. The festival is happening around us, hopefully not too close around us. We will see as the conversation goes. I have my next guest here. Bert Williamson has joined us. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
It's halfway through the festival, almost precisely, I'm guessing.
Not for me. I'm PBH Free Fringe, so we start on
the Friday.
The Saturday.
The Saturday. You don't have those weird previews in that.
No, none of that. We're going in full barrel. So I think...
Until the tattoo has started, yeah. You don't tell jokes.
Yeah. I only start jokes by a large size. But yeah, no, I'm 10 days in of 24, so I'm just over a third. Maybe I'm fresher faced.
Than the people who've been here since the Tuesday or the Wednesday when the previews begin.
Yeah, great.
Well, we're going to talk about the show. That is one of the things we're definitely here to talk about. But past, present, future is the format. So before we get into the present, let's very, very quickly talk me through your career in comedy. So let's start at the very start. We might then take some jumps to get up to the modern day in 5 minutes. But where did it all begin?
Great. Well, I started on the 1st of September 2018.
Wow, that's very well remembered.
Well, I remember because it was the first. So that's helpful to have it as that. And I did an open mic after an open mic. And the first open mic was a dreadful show. And then afterwards, if you weren't good enough to perform at the dreadful show, you got to do a show that was even worse than that.
And I remember it was the B-list open mic.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember doing that show after that. And then the host of the show came up to say, oh, that was great. Keep that up. You might one day get on the main show. And in my head, I'm just thinking, it was all rubbish. It doesn't matter. I didn't think.
Stick with it and we'll let you on the slightly less shit open mic.
Exactly. I didn't think of myself as particularly great. It was more just, I think this membrane is more permeable than you think. There isn't really any difference. But that was my first bit in comedy. I did that having done previously spoken word, improv, sort of, I guess, the knowing that I wanted to do something creative where I could express myself, for lack of a better phrase. That was sounds a bit weird. But I wanted to do something where I could do that. And then I settled on stand-up. And I was like, oh, cool. This is the thing that I have the most control of. And not to be rude, the most monetizable, as in I love improv, I love poetry, but I saw the people that were doing it and doing it really, really well, and they didn't seem like they were getting a living out of it, and that was for me the crucial thing.
Yes, it's challenging building a living in stand-up, but not compared to certainly spoken word.
I think I have huge respect for people that do that. That's incredible. Stand-up is, I think, great in that you work at it for ages, you get to a point where people are willing to pay you, and then more and more people seem to be willing to do that, and then before you know it, you have a living. So I was more aware of that path. That path is also, I think that's one of the good things about stand-up. You can see that path. You start out doing the unpaid middle spots, then you go to maybe some slightly paid middle spots, then you start opening gigs for an all right fee, and then one day you'll start to close gigs, and then it's not a great living, but it is a living. So that was evident to me at the time. So I was like, cool, this is not only the thing I enjoy the most, but this is the thing that I can dedicate my time to the most fruitfully. I mean, I didn't make the society with a living, but you have to get by. So that's one of the reasons why I ended up at stand-up specifically.
Now, you described the classic route into comedy there, basically very much through the gigging side, through the live side. So the open mics, and then you start doing the 5 minute, 10 minute middle slot, etc., etc. But you also said you started in 2018. So we know that while you were on that journey, something happened that basically shut that down for 18 months. So how was the pandemic for you as you were pursuing this career?
So I was pretty new before that. And I think comedy during the pandemic, I didn't do any. I'm interested in the live doing it live. Live is the best. I love it. I love performing to people. I love people having in the room. That's great. That's so brilliant. And the pandemic wasn't that. So I almost didn't want to torture myself.
So you just put it on pause.
I was like, let's just accept that the way that I want to do it isn't an option right now. There are greater, more important things happening than me not being able to express that dick joke that I've just thought of. So fine, I did that. But what it did do was make me think about what I really wanted out of comedy. And I wasn't happy with where I was at. It was fine, like, you progressed. But when I was coming out of it, I was like, cool, I'm doing these rubbish minimum wage jobs. I had three different minimum wage jobs because I hated the idea of doing just one 9 to 5. So I still worked 40 hours a week, more than that more often than not. But there were just all these odd ends because I just got so bored. And I decided that I would get more into the production end just because I was like, why would I get this minimum wage money to enrich someone else when I can start my own gig and effectively be paid to facilitate me doing the thing that I love? Comedy production isn't the thing that I love, but the end result is the thing that I love. So I was like, well, once I thought about that, I had the pandemic to sort of muse that over. It was a no-brainer. So I set up lots and lots of gigs and then basically was able to transition because of the part-time jobs, sort of lose one at a time. So I wasn't like a big dropping off, sort of weaning myself off that. And then I ran all these shows for ages, and that's how a lot of acts, I think, ended up knowing me as a guy that was running gigs. And then once I was ready, weaned myself off those gigs to become an act in my own right. I mean, I would argue that I've been an act the whole time, but I think if you do lots of production, acts start to see you as a gig that they can do rather than a peer. That's not to chastise anyone that has treated me like that. I know that that is the industry, but I didn't really want that relationship. I liked creating. I love writing shows. I love doing stand-up. So that was my journey. And then I still do a bit of production on the side to make ends meet. But primarily, touch wood, my living is entirely comprised, there we go, of just doing stand-up. So that was kind of the journey up until now, was one of just going, right, how do I get a living out of this? How do I get by? And it's fun. I think comedy's biggest blessing and its biggest curse is that it is all on you, for better or for worse, whether it is you getting out to get it or you going, why isn't anything happening for me? You have to go take it. There are many elements about the industry that are unfair.
And do you think after the pandemic, by saying, okay, I'm going to have two sides to this, ultimately, I want to be a performer, but I can also work on the industry side, put on gigs. So for a while, you're wearing the two hats. Did that few years putting on the shows and doing the business side, do you think that has then helped you in terms of your own comedy career? Not so much what's happening on stage, but in terms of now you know how you get gigs, what the deal is, et cetera, et cetera.
Maybe.
Or are you still navigating it?
I mean, acts gossip about how to get shows all the time. Yep. So I don't think that wasn't necessarily like arcane information that I'd received. I think it has helped my mentality of going, I mean, despite my accent, I am unfortunately nowhere near as wealthy as I sound, nor from a background that would be true. So it was always like, I need to get by. That is the definitive thing. And it does mean that when I've approached the fringe, I've approached it as something that I cannot afford to make a loss on. So I've made certain choices, like going with the free fringe and trying to play a marketing game within the fringe and going, how am I going to pitch my show? What am I going to do? How am I doing these different things? I think that is a useful macro mentality. I don't think it's given me some secret unlock. If it had, then I must be a worse actor than I think I am. That it's given me a leg up and that I'm still where I am. I'm very happy with where I am. I shouldn't do myself down. But I don't think it's given... I think it's given me maybe perspective, not an advantage. That's how I would phrase it.
So you led us into the Edinburgh side of this journey. So at what point did you decide, I'm going to come up to the festival and do your own show?
Well, neatly, it ties to the COVID fringe, because that is the first fringe I did.
So that was, yes. Okay, so let's remind ourselves, during the pandemic, we had 1 year no fringe, and then we had the streamlined fringe, the mini fringe.
The golden fringe. The best. It was the best fringe ever. I was... very new act. I did a 45-minute work in progress. I wanted to do a split bill. I couldn't find anyone. And I was like, It's either I go up or I don't. Fine, let's have a go at talking for 45 minutes. And I did that. I had full rooms every day. I made money. I couldn't believe it. Was genuinely like life affirming to go up, have people listen to me. I'm still surprised when people turn up for me. It's what an honor, what a privilege to have someone go, all the things at this festival go, I am going to go see that guy. And the COVID Fringe was a taste of that, admittedly, because there was less competition. But that sensation still is something I remember. It felt amazing. And then the financial security of that. God, I don't want people to think I'm just some money-grubbing loser. But I think it is something that you have to think about if you...
It's less money grabbing and just trying not to lose money, isn't it?
Right. I just can't afford to. Like, actors tell me that they've lost 10 grand on the Fringe and they'll moan about that. And I'm like, the fact that you can even afford to moan about that, is that not a sign of your privilege? The fact that that's an option. There are so many acts that cannot ever have that happen. Otherwise, they're just completely in the bin. So I think that was so affirming. And then that leg gave me the confidence to then push through and then... quit the various different jobs and then end up doing comedy full time. But that was amazing. It was a little bit of a rough landing to come back from not having done any comedy before and then doing a couple of COVID gigs and then coming up and speaking for 45 minutes. But I was very lucky. The Scotsman came in to review me because there was nothing else to review. and they were really nice. They gave me 4 stars for a work in progress, which gave me so much confidence to then go, oh no, I'm not bad at this. I'm not making a mistake.
Yeah, there's a good show here.
Yeah.
People should see it.
But it was a work in progress. I didn't really offer it up as anything to be remarked upon. So that was really, really, really heartening on every possible level. That was a really emboldening moment for me. And then just to hang out with my buddies, I really got to see what I think was the best of the Fringe.
And you've been back every Fringe since then?
Every Fringe. I can't afford to take breaks.
And so let's talk free. So you've mentioned several times you are doing a show as part of the PBH Free Fringe,
yep.
Which basically means it's free to get in, but not necessarily free to get out.
Oh, I hate that line. It is free to get out. I very much say in the bucket, pretty much quoting myself, I say it's an invitation to pay.
Yes. Because so if you love the show, most people hopefully will put something in the
bucket. Well, even if you think it's all right. But I like it because it is more accessible. And maybe this is egotistical. As a performer, I like that. I have to do a good show, otherwise you won't pay me. Great. Game on. That's really fun to me, to just absolutely back myself all the way until the end of the show and go, right, there are some people that can afford to pay me here. If I've not done a good show, they won't. That's brilliant. I mean, I don't want that to be too much of a thing. I don't want to feel like I'm a dancing monkey. But the Fringe, I think that's quite nice. And I find that audiences quite like that. And I've also found that, you know, on a good show, people are willing to agree with you and be quite generous on what they think the show is worth. Brilliant.
And the logic of the Free Fringe back in the early days, I'm old enough to remember the early days of Free Fringe, I guess was two things. A, by being a free show, it's less of a risk for the audience members, which means it's slightly easier to sell the show in such a crowded marketplace. And then the other side is they keep the venue production cost the absolute minimum, because stand-up, ultimately, a mic's all you need, which means that they are not spending thousands and thousands and thousands of building venues, which means they then don't have to pass that cost to you. So you're keeping the costs to the absolute minimum.
Yeah, great.
And the model still works?
Still works. I haven't had a Fringe where I extrapolated it out when I was like, oh, what if I earn that every month? And then I realized it was sort of an all right living. So if you do the month, you go, this is amazing. And then,
but I guess given, I mean, it's always been the way, but certainly since the pandemic, the narrative has been the cost of staying in Edinburgh for a month as a performer just keeps going up.
I think that is more of a problem for audiences. I'm really worried about the way that it's affecting audience behavior. For the acts, I am maybe a little bit less sympathetic because
if you know where to look, you can do it, is what you're saying.
Yeah, but also it's a choice. And I think like we can't perform without audiences. So yes, of course, it's important. Performers aren't exploited 100%. But if we make things more accessible for audiences, then that will happen for performers as well. Because what I've seen flowering in the streets now is there are more sort of two new audience member categories. I think the sort of person that can afford to come up here and mill around is now much more affluent than they have been previously, because it's not something you can do idly now to come to the Fringe and go, oh yeah, we'll stay somewhere for a little bit. What, 500 quid all in? We'll do a week. Yeah, great. I mean, forget it. That's not that's never happening. But what that does mean now is the people that are coming up, that are wealthy, are coming up for maybe 2-3 days, and they are coming up not willing to take pants on shows because they can't afford to, because they've paid through the teeth to be here. They're going to go see the person they've seen online,
yeah,
the person they've seen on TV, all these different things. So I think it's very act-centered to think about it in terms of, what about the performers? It is audiences that I am mainly concerned for. The Fringe should be, it's a beautiful celebration of performance, but performance cannot happen without people watching it. So I think to focus on performers talking about all the expenses, and then they'll go, I've spent £16,000 this Fringe. And it's like, well, maybe £2,000 was on accommodation. That is unreasonable.
Yeah.
But your production, your director, like, in terms of like a performer's expense at the Fringe, it is my main expense, or one of, because I'm with the Free Fringe. But these people in paid venues, that is percentage-wise not actually the most. And I know you could push back on that and go, yes, with the production, because accommodation costs more, production costs more to get the people up. Yes, but then I would refer you to my previous example of, that should be, I think, more concerned about audiences, because then that will benefit everyone. It's just having the volume of the people in the city. How can it be made accessible full stop, rather than focusing on one group over the other? The audience is the largest group of people that come to stay in Edinburgh. So I think really that's the thing that should be focused on, going, how do we make it accessible? How do we get people in? Are we running different train things for Glasgow? Are we doing all these different things? That it's not only that, we've seen the Lake Fringe really struggle, I think, in the last few years, because people are doing the train and they are staying in Glasgow and they can't stay because the last train's at 12. And you go, Edinburgh City Council, why not run trains till 3-4 a.m.
all night?
Right.
Just for a month.
But you think about like how expensive that would be compared to what a fix that would be. You go, brilliant. But that it's not seen like that, because it's going, well, I'm a performer, I'm staying in Edinburgh, what about this? And of course, I feel the same. I am a performer. But maybe this comes back. Maybe this comes back to me being a promoter. I think in the past, I'm very keen. Yeah, I've got to not refer to myself too much like that. Otherwise, people think I will be someone that can run a gig but can't tell a joke. But I think it's just taking like a bigger perspective on it and going, it's the audiences that we need to centre, because they are the ones that enable us to do the thing. And for performers, coming to the Fringe is a choice. For audiences, if they are going to go on a holiday, why would it be the Fringe when it's ridiculously expensive? We have to come to the Fringe if we want to do the thing, because it's the only place that happens. Holidays are everywhere. So to make it competitive and to make it accessible, my fear is that it's the people that just come up casually. It's audiences that can't afford all these expenses. And then you end up with, that's absolutely fine, I don't begrudge anyone for being wealthy, but you end up with wealthier, posher audiences, and people that I think deserve to enjoy art as much as anyone else can't do that.
We've brought ourselves up to the present day, so
yeah,
we should definitely spend our present day slot, rest of it, talking about this year's show.
Yeah, brilliant.
Tell us about the show.
This year's show is 104 kilograms of pure banter. That's not me describing it, that is the show's title. It's an hour of stand-up comedy about, basically the through line this year is predominantly a more light-hearted show than I have run in previous years. But it's just an examination of where I'm at in my life right now, is in feeling pressures to pursue certain mental health diagnoses. I've had many audience members tell me that they think I'm neurodiverse in many different ways. I even got a message yesterday, which was fun. I don't particularly mind, but it's an interesting trend to me that's happened, that not only people are describing themselves in these ways, that's fantastic, but I'm now feeling like they can put other people into these categories and stuff. That's an interesting thing to
diagnose through watching an hour of stand-up.
Right, and I think it's because stand-up's so personal, people go, oh, right, well, he's like me, and yeah. I'm this, which is, I always think, is such a flattering thing, that someone can engage with one's work that strongly and feel emboldened to say that. So this isn't a dismissal of that. It's, I think, more hopefully an earnest examination, but then also just an examination of both my physical health at the moment as well. I have a slipped disc. So I'm now living with chronic pain, and I have been for the last year and a half, and just sort of walking through how that's impacted my life and the day to day. But first and foremost, this is an hour of jokes that I have written that I very, very much like.
And with your Edinburgh shows, given it is part of your annual calendar now, do you write an hour specifically for Edinburgh, or is it sort of, you know, a amalgamation of stuff you've been doing throughout the year? How do you approach it?
So I'm still fairly new to comedy in the grand scheme of things. I've been going roughly 7 years, give or take a pandemic. And I think for me, I will typically, what I do is after the Fringe, I will then record the hour that I've done in the Fringe in a venue in Bristol to put it online for free. That's really nice. And that's nice to have that at the end and to do that to a home crowd. It feels lovely. So I do that. And then after that, I move on from the material that I've had. I don't do new material at paid gigs, but the plan then is to shelve that and then bring in new routines.
So the Fringe is giving you that discipline of basically over the year, by August, you have the hour show.
Yeah.
You perform it, you record it.
Well, I think for many reasons, as in I need to do the Fringe to make my career work financially, because this is like, if I mean, not to give you too much of a state of my finances, I had a very expensive year. If I had come up to the Fringe and not made any money, I would be broke, as in like properly bankrupt. I'd been in a lot of debt. Whereas now I'm okay. I'm frowning. If you're listening to this and you want to see what expression I have, but yeah, I'm out of the danger zone. But I have to come to the Fringe for that reason, and I have to make the Fringe work for that reason. Live work, like I said, is not lucrative, but I'm lucky that I tend to have a good time at the Fringe, and audiences like what I do. So I need to be here for that reason. But also as a discipline, it's fantastic. I think if I hold on to the same jokes too long, I think I end up holding myself back, because I think you can write a certain joke, and then if you learn how to perform it perfectly, the moment you've got that perfected, you don't learn anything new about comedy after that. Whereas the analogy I always use is so stupid. Hermit crabs can only get as big as the shell that they're in. And I think a show is like a shell. You can grow into it. And then if you're a newer act, once that's done, you need to remove that shell, find a bigger shell to become a better act. I'm still early in my journey, so I'm finding different shells. Maybe 1 year I'll be like, cool, I can't get any better than this. But right now I still feel like my performance is an ongoing process. So I very much like that discipline. Filming it feels great. And that's a way that I can tie it into the online sphere without necessarily having to play that game too harshly, because I do love live more than anything. I don't really want to record stuff for online. So by recording the show and then putting it out there like that, I found that works well for me.
And it's a way of documenting, isn't it? I often think about all of the great shows that were performed here in the 90s and 2000s, which are sort of lost.
Forever, yeah.
Because the comedians now are off performing different stuff, and they very rarely go back to those, and it's probably not even appropriate for them to go back to those really early shows.
Yeah.
But maybe on one level, it's good that they were there and they're gone, but then part of you is like, oh, I'd love to go back and watch, you know, I don't know, what the Mighty Boosh were doing back in the 2000s.
So what you're saying is in 20 years, I'll get cancelled for my show.
That you're doing now.
Yeah. No, I think it's nice. That was one of the considerations, is I now have that forever.
Yeah.
Because it's so fleeting, the way that like a joke can work in a room. But then just to have, I think a stand-up special is not a live gig. It's closer to a documentary of a live gig. It is a replication of what that experience might be like. And it's nice. It's nice to take that forever. I like to think, you know, one day I'll be in my rocking chair and be like, oh, do you hear Granddad used to do stand-up comedy? And they go, yeah, he was shit.
Well, we've moved on to future. So let's just quickly wrap up with that. So is the plan basically to do what you've just described? You're going to record this show.
Mm-hmm.
Then
we go again.
You go again. And you'll be here next year, and the plans will start pretty much as soon as this one's over.
Yeah, I think it's nice in that I'm always keen to keep these thoughts at bay, because you need to live in the show that you have. But I do have emerging ideas for what the next year's show would be and how I would write and pitch that. And you have to have, a scheme. For me, it's very much like a school year stand-up, which is great. I will film it, and then I'll be done in October, and then I will sit down and I'll go, right, cool, what am I doing with my school year this year? What's my show about? What are some objectives I have with the industry? Is there a particular club that I want to be in this year? And I think of it in that sort of grand scheme. But it's very much film it, do it, and then we go again. I love the process. I think Chelsea Clopey had this lovely line in her last show last year, which was fantastic. She was talking about Sisyphus rolling the boulder up the hill, and how Camus described that as, and you must imagine Sisyphus happy, the act of rolling the boulder must be enough. And I'm nowhere near as erudite or smart as she is, but the idea of like, oh yeah, you've got to love rolling that boulder. That is the Edinburgh Fringe. It can feel futile. It can feel repetitive. But if you like rolling boulders, my God, you are going to have a great time here. And I love it. So that's the process. I'm excited. I think a trap if you get too excited about what the next show will be. Suddenly the show that you're doing...
And you write it off halfway through the festival.
Right. And there are loads of jokes in there that are really exciting and tweaks that I've made, even in this run, that have made it more and more fun for me to do. So that's great. But I just love the process. I love writing stand-up. I love doing stand-up. And that's why I know I've chosen the right career. If you don't, you will meet stand-ups that don't like doing stand-up. And I think, my God, there are jobs you can do where you get paid more and much easier. You don't have to do this. You could work in IT in somewhere near where you live, and then you won't have to drive around the country, and you'll get paid more, and you'll be able to see your family and your friends a lot more. So I think, like anything, you have to ask yourself why you're doing it. Not to go back to the past, but I remember when I was starting out in stand-up, I was scared to ask myself whether I enjoyed it, because it was so existential for me. I was like, I must do this thing. And it was more precarious. Now that I think I'm a little bit more established in it, maybe with a small E, but now that I feel much more comfortable in it and more comfortable in myself, now that I'm 30, I'm not 23 anymore when I started out, I feel very comfortable asking myself, why am I doing this? Do I like doing it? And the answer has been every year, my God,
yes.
I love it. A resounding yes. But I think even being able to ask that question, you have to get to a point of confidence in what you're doing and yourself. It's this, like I said, it's the self-expression that I love. I was thinking about this, if I ever got banned from doing stand-up for non-bad reasons, if let's just say, for whatever reason, an alien forbids me, would that be the end of my life? No, I would find another form of self-expression. Maybe I'd go back to improv, maybe I'd go back to poetry. So it's just knowing why you're doing the thing, I think, really helps keep me going. And the answer is always because I love it. So,
okay. Awesome. Well, we should wrap up there. But before we do that, just very quickly give us the listings where people can come and see the show.
You can find me at 3:05 p.m. at the Voodoo Rooms, Carte Blanche, every day until the 24th, including the 24th, right up until the end of the festival. 3:05 p.m. on weekends. Please do get there early. It's not ticketed, and I have had to turn people away.
And where do people find you online?
They can find me online. Primarily, I would say at Burt Comedian, spelled B-U-R-T for Burt. And if you can't manage that, don't bother. I don't need you. You'd be holding me back.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.